Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Fall Podcast as we check our audio levels. Poke check, rap check, slap check, back check, kayak, rusty gate check. 1, 2, 1, 2, we're here in Inside Lacrosse offices downtown Baltimore. Welcome, everybody. It's been a while already as we entered the college football season. I've toured around the country, had some wonderful travel, seen some lacrosse people in Sydney, Australia. Went to a lacrosse practice, the first one of the year, in Happy Valley at Penn State. Spoke to lacrosse fans at Washington State, yes, Pullman, Washington, and they asked me who I liked in my picks, and I gave them my top four. We'll talk about that. I had Duke number one. I think I had Yale 2, Albany 3, and Denver 4. Some of the usual suspects. Spent a week at Alabama. Nick Saban watched them practice on Thursday. You talk about excellence. And then last week, UCLA game, Jim Mora Jr., his son Ryder, now a freshman at Maryland. And we spoke about the transition that freshmen make from high school to college and how challenging that is. Right now, though, I want to bring in Terry Foy and Matt Kinnear of Inside Lacrosse. And first thing, guys, you've been out in the field, which I think is so valuable, and I love the way Inside Lacrosse gets out there to these teams. I think you're going to hit about 20 by the end of the fall. I'm going to start with you, Terry. You've been to Ohio State, Duke, North Carolina, and Syracuse. Tell me about the Buckeyes, because I'm really interested. I've got the Buckeyes as one of my fuzzy teams this year. You know, they made that magical run. They lost a lot of seniors last year, but they do bring back a ton of talent, and Ben Randall and Trey LeClaire. I'm not sure where this team fits nationally. You know, are they good enough now to be considered a top 10 team every year, or will there be a step backwards?
So first, I want to make 2 points about what the fall is. It's an incredibly casual environment to actually have conversations that you can't have at any other point in the year. When you're on the recruiting trail in the summer, also more casual than during the season, but there's just so many people around all the time. It's never like a really hearty connection with one person. And then secondly, this is part of an overarching video project that we're putting together called The Season, and I just want to make sure that that's on everybody's radar, because that's why I went to the four programs that I did, and it's going to be really cool. So I want to
beyond cool. I just saw the trailer. Let me. I had goosebumps. Like, you know, you could put that trailer on any network in America, and they'd run it in a second based on what I'm seeing. The quality is off the charts. The storylines, beautiful video, just amazing.
Yeah, so check out theseason.com for all the trailer as well as all subsequent 10 episodes from here through May. But as far as Ohio State is concerned, to me, you contextualize the questions heading into 2018 this way. They had program high watermarks in 2013 and 2015. They made it to the quarterfinals for the second and third time in program history, and then they regressed and had 500 or below seasons in 2014 and 2016. Now, coming off of a new high watermark, a national championship game appearance, how do they avoid a three-peat of that regression? And I think that I look first to the fact that the personnel on those teams in 13 and 15 were very star-centric. Logan Shuss and Jesse King and Dominique Alexander bore a tremendous amount of responsibility for the success that those teams had. I think that the 2017 Buckeyes were much more well-rounded. You look at Eric Fennell and how much he emerged over the course of the season, and it's not impossible to imagine there's a guy on that roster that's capable of doing the same thing this year. But you mentioned Ben Randall and Trey LeClaire, and I think that there are stars that surround those guys as well. They're an interesting team in the sense that they have to replace their faceoff specialist and their goalie, who were, you said this multiple times last year, the best battery of those two guys in college lacrosse, and I think that that creates some apprehension, some anxiety on the coaching staff. But I think more than anything else, the coaching staff's approach has formalized, right? So they've reduced the year-to-year volatility to a degree that the veterans in the program know what they're expect know what is expected of them and what to expect from the staff, and I think that the newcomers, there's fewer questions because they are getting the trickle-down effect as well.
They have a process.
Exactly.
And now it's proven to work.
And they call it their blueprint, and I think that the most fascinating thing for this fall is how much box they're playing. They're playing either once or twice a week, legitimate, bona fide box. So they're having indoor practice, and as a result, basically half the group is competing all the time. And then, you know, when they're off the floor, they have three box teams on their roster. And so the third team is running through drills on the other field. And it's just, it does a couple of things that I think are exactly what the fall is all about. You get better as an individual lacrosse player as opposed to getting better as a lacrosse team, right? So, like, the accumulation of every player getting better is what makes the team better. And then the second thing is it's fun. And I think the fall, lacrosse fans don't realize for how many players the fall is not fun because there's no game every week to break up the monotony. And so battling how not fun it can be is one of the significant challenges of a coaching staff. And I think Ohio State has very organically solved that problem.
I always had fun during the fall because Don Zimmerman, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame, congratulations, coach, he made our practices a quarter skill development, maybe a quarter team installation or team, you know, team defense, clearing, and then half play. We scrimmaged a ton, and he always made it, if it was New York, Maryland, it was, you know, by class, and he split it up and it'd be competitive. But I thought the most important thing about the fall was putting in the extra time prior to and after practice, because your academic schedule, you should be in control of things. The weather is amazing. So, you know, 15 minutes beforehand working on inside saves, 15 minutes afterwards working on outlet passes. And I think if all players follow a similar formula, put in your individual time before and after practice, you'll achieve some great things. A team, I think, who's on the cusp of a historical season for their program would be Rutgers. And they're a team I rank somewhere between 5 and 10 this season. I think not only can they get into the tournament this year, I think they can win a playoff game if the stars come together. They've identified a playing style, which is unique. It's fast. It's fun. And now they're getting healthy. Adam Shalambides.
The most fun name to say in college lacrosse.
And Christian Trasolini, whose name is not a mouthful compared to Adams. They should be back in the fold. This team's good. How good can they be, Matt? You saw them practice.
Yeah, Jeff Shannon and I went up to Piscataway to check out Rutgers. They were the first day of their fall practice. And, you know, really we were there to see Shalambides, and Trasolini was kind of the focal point of our visit there. But, you know, it's remarkable. Those two guys, them getting hurt, you know, Shalambides, he tears his ACL in preseason practice last January. Then 8 days later, Christian Trasolini does the same thing, an even more complicated injury. Rutgers, you know, if you looked at Rutgers from 4 years ago, that would have derailed that team. That season would have just been lost into the ether. They're not going to, you know, really accomplish anything. And this is a team that went and won 10 games in that next season, was the number one team in the country. Really special what they've built. And I think what it shows is, you know, we're talking about those two players now because they're in the comeback. But it shows what Brian Brecht has built in the sense of the depth, you know, the inroads he's made in the recruiting. He's gotten a lot of these guys who have been, you know, committing their late of their senior year. You know, Scott Beda was kind of the backbone of this program for so many years, and he didn't enroll at Rutgers until a month before the fall started. You know, he was previously committed to Manhattan. And then you have a guy like Shalambides, who's a similar boat. He came to a prospect day and then, you know, his senior year and committed to Rutgers. So this is going to be a team that's really good. The thing that sets them apart is 13 seniors, and these guys have all seen significant time. 11 of those guys are pretty much guys who are in and out of the starting rotation for that team. And there's just something really special when you have a group of players who have seen that much time, who are so invested, and particularly for these guys, have a chip on their shoulder because they've been so good, they've made such strides, but have been just short of that final goal of making the NCAA tournament for 2 years in a row.
They've had moments. They've had moments in the last 2 years, and I think you know with those seniors now they can. I think they'll have those moments again this year, but I think long term, Big Ten tournament and beyond, I just think they'll have the mindset to accomplish something that they haven't done at Rutgers potentially.
And it's one thing that, you know, it shows what the Big Ten brand does for a program. You know, Coach Breck talked a lot about that. The media exposure, the television exposure they've gotten since they've been Big Ten, the resources. You know, you talk to Shalambides about his recovery process and the things he had at his disposal to get better. Big Ten is just remarkable what it does for a program's fortunes.
There's one comparison, because my issue with Rutgers is how much faith can you put in them, given that they haven't done it before? And I'm talking specifically about Final mm-hmm. Four-level expectations.
Well, getting to the tournament's one thing. I mean, and that's they've been on the cusp. They were the 2 years ago. They were the last team out, correct?
Right. And then last year, they were the second last team out, depending on how you sliced it, you know, with them and Army. My thing is, you know, what is the track record for teams that go from out of the tournament to Final Four quality the following year? And the one that comes to mind is the 2012 Loyola Greyhounds. And the reason is because...
Not Towson?
No, not really. No.
2 years ago?
Well, yeah. I mean, they made the tournament the year before.
Yeah.
So, no, I think Loyola was the team in 2011 that, you know, they had a couple of injuries that were setbacks. They were on the cusp, right? They were, like, close to being a tournament team after, in 2010, having lost in the first round against
Clemson. Right. They had that giant senior class that finally put it together. Yeah.
So my point is, if you're looking for a team that makes you feel more confident in Rutgers' capacity for taking what is a larger step than most programs typically do, that's one that I would point to.
The Big Ten is going to be very competitive, too. Mm-hmm. You know, after watching Penn State practice, I love their defense. They're going to be a defensive foundation team. They've got a lot of question marks at the midfield. Grant Amen is back. Johns Hopkins, I think, has to be better next year. How much better, I don't know. But that defense can't be as bad, and I think Michigan will improve with a new coach. If they can play better defense, they're going to win 1, 2, 3 more games, I think. So I think Michigan will be better. So Rutgers' job is going to be difficult. You know, I think Maryland will take a slight step back. How far? Who knows? But that the Big Ten once again, I think, will be awesome. Another team that I ranked number one on one of my epic plane trips, what was Duke, and Terry, you were at Duke. Did you see the type of team who can make a run to Boston and beyond?
So I wasn't there for a full-fledged practice. It was stick work and conditioning, and that's a really good environment to judge athleticism. It's hard to analyze athleticism when there's no second team to compare them to, right? Now, I visited three additional teams, and I can get a little bit of a sense, but it wasn't at the same time. So that being said, these guys are so fast and so ripped, and it was just – it really stood out, you know? And first of all, that's kind of always been Duke's MO, right? They, you know, are the combination of skill and speed that allowed them to win three national championships in 4 years – or 5 years. But beyond that, this particular team – the storyline that is going to emerge from my perspective, last year was about the defense and how much better they played, and they played better defense than they had since their national championship teams. And I think that because of what they return, you know, with the exception of the fact that, you know, they need two new shorties, but based on the athleticism, hopefully they have those guys in the stable. They will play more defense because they presumably don't have – well, they don't have Kyle Rowe, so they will – presumably play more defense is the way that that should be said. So for me, what I think is that the threshold of Duke being a quarterfinal team again and Duke being a Final Four national championship team is Justin Gutterding. Mentally, he was their lefty scorer for me, for including last year, and that was problematic because he's not that anymore. He is a quarterback. He is a Mantanowski, Ned Crotty. He is not a Josh Dion, Max Quinzani anymore the way he was his first 2 years in the program.
He's a quarterback, but he's not an X.
Right. He's controlling the offense. I mean, he plays a little bit behind the goal, but you're right. He's controlling the offense from the wing, and it'll be fascinating to see because they have – you know, last year, to me, their ceiling was going to be defined by the consistency and continuity of their midfield, and I think that ultimately proved true. When they had some great wins, and their midfield played well. They were playing four freshmen. They had some bad losses, and their midfield didn't show up, and I think that that was ultimately what we saw when their season ended. I think you can expect those guys, whoever ends up emerging, being more consistent. Like I said, I think the defense is a little bit more of a known quantity. You know, I'm really fascinated by how Duke builds its offense around Gutterding and how he performs to the level of taking them to that national championship caliber team.
Duke's going to be a good team. I don't think there's any question about that. You talk about improvement, and I think about teams who are experiencing a current coaching change or teams who did last season. You know, as I mentioned, I think Michigan can improve. Jacksonville's a program. I think that'll take the logical step forward now that that culture, now that those expectations, now that the process has been installed. You know, a team like Vermont also, they get back Ian McKay. I think they'll be better. And then Delaware, you know, Ben DeLuca will come in, and It'll be interesting to see. And Matt, I want to get your opinion. You spoke with Ben recently. Is he going to have to clean house? Is his vision of that program in line with what's there right now? Or is he going to have to clean house and completely break it down before he builds it back up?
You know, I think it's a little bit more of the latter, break it down and then build it back up. You know, the phrase he kept using when I talked to him was everything's on a clean slate. You know, he didn't come in with any predisposed expectations about, you know, who the leaders are on this team, who are the guys who he's going to lean on. He wants that to emerge, you know, when he's in the room with these guys and working with them. Right now, they're kind of in a phase where they're doing conditioning. You know, they haven't been on the field yet, which is new for Delaware. Usually they've been on the field by this point of the fall. You know, he's working on, you know, very strict fundamentals and conditioning right now. And, you know, from what I've heard, you know, this isn't from his mouth directly, but from what I've heard, he's working them pretty darn hard. You know, something that maybe we haven't seen at Delaware in a while. So I think he's going to break them down pretty good. And, you know, the thing with Delaware is you go to their field house and you get a sense of change just in the air. You know, with there's been a lot of changes in the athletic department as a whole at Delaware, even structurally. They've moved the offices where, you know, where Coach Bob Schillinglaw was upstairs in the field house. Now DeLuca is downstairs, the first office when you walk in to the field house. It's a very Spartan, you know, cinder block walls, you know, but it's a place where he can see all the players come and go. You know, and he said that was important to him, having a spot where he's close to his assistants and he can see which guys are going into the locker room, which guys are going to work out. You know, I think he's going to make a lot of significant changes to this program. You might see them kind of you know, maybe have a year where they don't really exceed their win total, but they're building for something greater. And, you know, Coach DeLuca, his wife is a Delaware alum. His wife is from the Philadelphia area. It seems like he's in a spot after a few years of being a little bit nomadic with his volunteer assistant at Duke, going to Harvard. He's ready to put some roots down and build something for the long term, you know, not just use this as a stepping stone for some other job. So I'm really thinking he wants to build in his own vision the foundation of this program.
I think he will. I think he can.
And certainly Delaware is a place that's been committed to its men's lacrosse coach and allowing him to build deep roots.
You mentioned Spartan conditions, a school that does not have Spartan conditions, but they are also experiencing a facelift in their facilities as North Carolina. Terry, you were in Chapel Hill. Did you get to see, is the indoor facility, are there beams up? Is it done? And what's going on with Fetzer Field right now?
Yeah, so with Fetzer, the fences are so high you can't really see, like, what, I mean, you know there's a huge hole in the ground, and you can hear all of the construction emerging from it, nothing to the degree that I was able to say, like, okay, I know that that's going to be an office building, that's going to be a grandstand, whatever else. But it's cool because they've been able to modify where and what they do pretty easily. So their practice field is only, you know, one field length farther away from their locker room than Fetzer was, and probably didn't practice on the grass very much anyway. And they're going to be playing all their games in Keenan Stadium, which their locker rooms are actually in. So I think it's going to be a pretty smooth transition for the interim while they're waiting for the facility to get built.
What caught your eye in terms of the product on the field?
That there are a lot of question marks, and I think that it's not a function of who's good and who's not, or who is returning and who's not. That actually is one of the questions. Shane Simpson was around the program as he awaits whether he's going to be going to grad school at Carolina and spending another season with the team. A couple other guys that are not there because of their grad school aspirations and are studying in England. So I think in that respect, that's one of the things that I mean when I say question marks. Another thing that caught my eye after – I don't think people realized exactly how much continuity that staff had from 2008 until 2016. The only position change in among the four guys, the volunteer, two full-time assistants, and head coach, was Pat Meyer's departure and Dave Metzbauer's arrival. You know, to then have significant turnover, 50% of that group turnover in the subsequent year was always going to be a challenge. And it feels like everybody is a little bit more comfortable in their role in year two, and I think that there's going to be a lot of value there. The last point I would make is we talked earlier about the degree of a step that a program needs to take. Carolina had to get over the quarterfinal hump and then turn that into a national championship. You know, that's a relatively far step given what we had seen out of Maryland, obviously, given what we had seen out of Denver, you know, some of the other recent national champions who were knocking on the Final Four door. And I think that it's reasonable to say, as a result of how far that step was, learning to cope with the success was going to be a little bit steeper than it would have been at Denver or Maryland. And I think that they got served, right? That last season presented a lot of challenges.
They lost a zillion games last year.
Exactly.
Rallied, you know, at the end, and it was a great rally,
right,
you know, in the ACC tournament. But along the way, man, did they lose a ton of games
or
what?
They rallied pretty well in the end in their last game of the year against
Albany,
too. Yeah.
And I think that the cumulative total of that is a harder mindset heading into 2018. And, you know, that mental toughness is going to go a long way toward determining, you know, are they a 13-3 team or a 10-6 team?
They're a fuzzy read in my book preseason. It's hard for me to, you know, quantify what I expect for Carolina. There's a lot of teams like that in my eyes. You know, Virginia, you got Ryan Conrad. I don't love their senior and junior class. I think they got their best two classes are their freshmen and their sophomores. A team like Loyola, you know, Spencer's back. He's a star. Who else you got? You know, Navy, they lose Reese and Fennell on defense, but they could bring back Casey Reese. He's a star. And then a team like Princeton. And you were there, Matt. Mike Sowers, what he did last year was just eye-catching, unbelievable. You saw him in action last week, I believe, or the week prior. What did you see from the Tigers?
Yeah, they were in the individual aspect of their preseason, or of their fall, excuse me. So they, you know, it's very limited time where they only have essentially half the guys on the field at any given moment. Mike Sowers was absolutely the best player on there, and he is on a very short list for Player of the Year heading into this year. And that's not hyperbole. That's just absolutely the truth. And Terry, you mentioned this earlier. It's actually both of your comments. You mentioned earlier about having fun and how important that is. Quint, you mentioned earlier about the work before and after practice. Michael Sowers, I talked to him. This summer he spent playing box in Philadelphia. He was playing in a men's box league and just loved it. He's a complete lax rat, loves to play. You know, he mentioned that he used to play football in high school and every football practice was a grind. And he's lacrosse. He's like, you know, I just love coming and playing lacrosse at practice. So he's having fun out there. After practice, you know, the coaching staff was working with the other half of the group, and he got a football pylon out, and he was on his knees shooting from behind the pylon, working on it, extending his hands, because that's a weakness that he saw in his game, was these guys trying to kind of hit him when he was coming up above GLE, and he was working on extending his hands. He was one of the last guys to leave the field. He could have left at any point in that half of the practice, and he stayed out there because he loves to do the work. But this team, you know, it's going to be a team that's going to have these. If they're going to win games, they're going to score 15 goals to win them, and they're going to give up 14. You know, I still think they're at that point of their maturation. The thing that's a big wild card, and Terry, this is another point you brought up, is the staff consistency. This is the sixth defensive coordinator in 6 years for Princeton.
Good point.
Jeremy Hirsch, you know, and I talked with Coach Madelon after, you know, something that was important to him was finding a candidate that is going to build kind of long-term groundwork, not someone who's going to be kind of, I'm here for my one-year stint and I'm going to move on to somewhere else. Hirsch is an alum. You know, he's a guy who was comfortable kind of building on Bernhardt's system that he had in place, as opposed to, you know, recreating something new and having all new language. So he really kind of sees the value in building some consistency there, because all these guys who are playing on this defense have had a different coordinator every year that they've been on the field. You know, that's, you know, Quint, you would know more than anyone how difficult that can be.
Yeah. Jesse Bernhardt's the defensive coordinator now at Maryland. I thought Princeton's staff last year did a wonderful job. You look at the Ivy League, and you know, I have Yale in the top four. I have Yale ranked number two potentially preseason. I think this is the best Yale team ever. I think they will dominate the Ivy League. Cornell will be better this year, no doubt, with Jeff Teat. After that, I'm not sure who to lock in on. Penn is a fuzzy in my eyes. But you know, when I look at a star player, I think of Sowers. When I think about Syracuse this year and what they return, do they have a star player?
No.
Terry Foy?
I mean,
when was the last time Syracuse was without like a guy you could nominate for first or second team All-American, and is their best player Nick Mellon if he's healthy? And you know, this is a Syracuse team, quite honestly. I could see losing to Albany early in the year. I could see them losing to Rutgers, who's now on their schedule. And then they got the ACC. It's hard for me to think that the Orange are going to have a top eight season.
I think this roster is a little reminiscent of their 2015 roster in the wake of Dylan and Kevin Rice's graduation. And I think that you saw, Sergio Sausalito emerged late in the year, and Nick Mariano emerged, and that was the continuity that they were going to carry into 2017. I think I misspoke. I meant the 2016 roster. It reminds me of 2 years ago. I think that their likeliest star is Nate Solomon. He's a right-handed attackman, kind of wing player. It'll be fascinating to see how their unit develops at attack. I wouldn't be surprised to see Brendan Bomberry move to the midfield, and Steven Rafus, who emerged down the stretch of last season.
Nice player. Very talented.
Alongside Bradley Voigt. I could see the three of those guys being their starting attack. And I think that they're going to have tremendous midfield depth. I think that they're going to be in a situation that was reminiscent of Duke last year, in the sense that they're going to have four or five freshmen that deserve to get on the field right away. I think that the guy that has emerged early is Tucker Dordovic out of Portland Jesuit in Oregon. He's fantastic. I think Dami Oladomoye is going to get on the field, whether he's a short stick D-midi or playing offense as well. I think Lucas Quinn out of Niskayuna is another guy. Yeah. He's a big step-down shooter. And they've got two additional freshmen that come in with high expectations or a lot of kind of hype surrounding them. Jacob Buttermore out of the Philly area, and then Brendan Curry out of Calvert Hall. So they have tons of options, and that's before you even get to some of the returning upperclassmen. But like Duke this year, they have to replace Ben Williams at the faceoff X. And they have to replace Evan Malloy in goal. Huge question marks. And with, if they are facing some of the challenges that Duke faced last year when they had those two rocks, if they're facing those question marks all across their roster, and they also have, these challenges at faceoff and in goal, I don't disagree. I think that there's the possibility for some really tough sledding. With respect to Nick Mellon, obviously he's coming back from missing last season. He's not coming back from an ACL or anything like that. So you can expect him to hit the ground running in a way that a lot of season-ending injuries or season-missing injury guys don't. So him paired with Austin Fusco, I think that, they've got some cornerstones in the long pole. Still, they have to replace their shorties as well. I mean, Gillis and Safari were huge contributors for this team. So question marks all over the field for the roster. Having visited practice, the one thing that I took away more than anything else is, for a team that has a reputation for having so much talent, they spend a lot of time teaching, and I was really impressed by that. And it's, whether it's teaching how to do drills or it's teaching individual skills, they really are locked in on their process. And I think that it's fascinating, what Syracuse has been in the post-Powell era. The majority of John Desko's tenure in Syracuse from 2005 to the present, which has been remarkably successful by any standard other than Syracuse's lacrosse's previous standard.
Good point. Yep.
Is a testament to how good they are at teaching and coaching on a daily basis.
Well, Syracuse will play the Iroquois Nationals this fall. Matt, you're heading up to see the Orange. Mm-hmm. It's a little double dose of Kinnear and Foy, and then you're going to swing over to Cornell to watch Jeff Teat play. Big events coming up Sunday, October 8th, USA Towson and Israel Towson at the U.S. Lacrosse facility in Sparks. This Saturday, October 7th, which I cannot watch, is Team USA against Maryland. And you think about Connor Kelly coming back from Maryland. I think they're going to have to play some youngsters on attack. Maryland's defense will be okay. They always are okay. But, can Connor Kelly continue? I thought he was a revelation last year because I had labeled him as a benefactor. He was more than a benefactor of the great players last year. I thought he had one of the best goal-scoring years for a midfielder in a long time. He'd be on my short list of Tuaratan guys with Connor Fields from Albany, who should – I see no reason why his production won't be gigantic. Ben Reeves, obviously, out of Yale. Patrick Spencer at Loyola, got to find out what his supporting cast. And then some of the guys like a Michael Sowers. Can Ryder Garnsey put it together? Trey LeClaire, he was a force of nature late in the season last year.
What about a guy out in the Rocky Mountains who's going to end the season as the best player at his position
Trevor
ever?
Baptiste, yeah, I got him. Even Ethan Walker would be lower on my list. I just don't. And if Denver won the national championship and Baptiste is dominant throughout the tournament, I could see giving him the award. Anything short of that, I don't think he gets the award. But in my eyes, he is the best college collegiate faceoff man in the history of the sport. I mean,
no, I think that not only will the numbers bear that out, but he passes the eye test too. I mean, if you are an opponent of faceoff specialists, Trevor Baptiste is the type of player who what he does with the ball and his stick will impress you. It's just that the demands of the position are such that he doesn't ever not do that, right? And so I think that's what's going to be fascinating about the experimentation this fall, particularly with respect to the shot clock, is off of goals, how do teams utilize their faceoff specialist? Do they think it's worth, if you win, burning the time to sub him off, or are you incentivized to let him play offense?
Well, you have to remember this summer, Baptiste was in the Colorado, the box league out there, and he didn't take a single draw out there. He was playing offense the whole time. So, you know.
That's fantastic.
Be scared if you're a Big East.
That's great cross training. And I mentioned the events at US Lacrosse on October 7th and 8th. The following weekend in Baltimore, I believe, you have Ohio State and North Carolina. You've got a Headstrong event on Long Island, which is a big one. Bucknell, Hartford, Hofstra, Penn State, and Lehigh. Rutgers, I believe, is hosting UMass and Loyola that same day. And then Sunday the 15th in Baltimore, another Headstrong event at Boys Latin School. A good one. Army, Johns Hopkins, Albany, and Richmond. So those are, in my eyes, those are the premier weekends of the fall. You guys mentioned the 60-second shot clock. And it's going to be interesting to see the data, to see the opinions, both from the coaches and the players and the referees. You know, from covering Major League Lacrosse for 15 or so years, more emphasis on riding, I think you'll see. If you can chip into that clock, it really helps out your defense. Are we going to see more zones? Without the two-point arc, are we going to see zone busters? You know, the shot clock gets down to 20. Are you going to substitute Foy in for a 16-yard cannon? I think goalies will matter more, because they're going to see bad shots late in the shot clock. And then I think ex-attackmen are more valuable. Think about those shots that go wide with 12 seconds to go on the shot clock. You need a viable option at X. Teams with a viable option on that restart are in an advantageous position, I think. And then the ability to play multiple defenses. You know, can you switch from man to zone or switch back? Do you have some shutoff action going on late in the shot clock? So I think there are more coaching scenarios that will really reward the excellent coaches. Do you guys have any anecdotal evidence from anything you saw over the past 2 weeks in regard to the 60-second shot clock?
No, I didn't see anybody, with the exception of Ohio State playing with a shot clock in box, because that's what box rules dictate, I didn't see any evidence of a shot clock in any of the practices that I attended. That being said, these are very, very early in the spring, or I'm sorry, in the fall. And so as a result, you know, shot clock type stuff isn't going to be, you know, that's week of the scrimmage type stuff. Two thoughts that I want to communicate. The first is I'm incredibly glad that the experimental rules start on the defense gaining possession as opposed to when the ball crosses the midline. Because if it were the latter, you really disincentivize transition
push,
play.
I know.
Exactly. And I think not enough people realize that.
Sub first, then clear.
Exactly.
That is a brutal, horrible, poorly thought out rule.
And I think that there was some possibility that that was going to be the route that they decided to go.
Please,
and so,
no. Please, no.
And so I think the fact that the experimentation doesn't allow for that is great. The second point is, and this was a conversation I had a few times in early August when this came out, is why do we all hate zone? Like, why is zone defense so despised? I don't even, like, is it because man-to-man is literally a more manly way to play? Like, I don't really understand when you watch an effective zone offense, it emphasizes ball movement and off-ball cutting in a way that it creates beautiful offense, much better than individual dodging. Like, I don't understand. You're still going to have to score goals regardless of whether there's a shot clock or not. It's not like you get to not play offense. You're just going to play a different style of offense, and this idea that the style of defense is going to dictate this really unattractive offense and this unattractive style of play, I don't see the logic there at all.
And when, you know, this point, and this is a point that Patrick McEwen brought up, when coaches are forced to coach against zone defense more, aren't their offenses that they create going to be a lot better, you know, as they start to coach them?
No doubt.
I mean, it's kind of a natural, you know, chicken and the egg thing there. And, you know, talking about the zones, I actually had a really good conversation with Coach Madelon when I was at Princeton about, you know, he's an MLL player. He's a goalie in the MLL. You know, he knows a lot about the shot clock. And, you know, he pointed to the Ohio Machine as kind of a team that made the best use out of a zone defense in response to the shot clock and, you know, how you can kind of effectively defend against it. So I think there are, you know, which also brings up the point of these coaches who are this younger tier of coaches who have coached, who have played in the MLL, what kind of advantage are they going to get with this shot clock era that might be looming?
And also, how much is their input going to drive the likelihood of adoption, right? So, like, you know, just because it's being experimented with in the fall doesn't mean that the NCAA is going to vote to include a shot clock in the summer of 2018. But two things could potentially really sway that. The first is, if coaches love the result of the product on field, I'm still middling on that because we've experimented with the shot clock in the past and never created a groundswell. And then the second is, if next spring there's a high-profile instance of stalling or anything else that really does, or really more than anything else, the implementation of a subjective timer on stall shot clock situation, that's going to be what actually like solicits a groundswell of support for a permanent shot clock. You know, those are going to be the two things to keep an eye on in terms of whether or not this is actually going to come to fruition.
I'd like to see you guys address that maybe in a December or January issue. On the newsstands inside Lacrosse, October is all about recruiting. The 2017s, they are on campuses right now,
yep,
competing for spots. 2018s, that's a rising seniors across the country, and then 2019s, and we're hoping to talk to Jeff Shannon here later on this podcast about those groups. The November issue, I think it's a fascinating one. The adversity issue is what they're calling it around here, about comeback players like Tim Rotance at Maryland, who dealt with vertigo, and Syracuse's Nick Mellon, who's had multiple injuries.
Yeah, so he missed the year because of a shoulder injury, and you know, it's fascinating to talk to a guy who had to make a decision as to whether or not to hang up the year.
Does anyone get this thing on newsstands, by the way?
Oh yeah, big time, 100%.
Any comments about Tim Rotance with his vertigo?
Rotance, he's clearly a coach's son. You know, he's definitely one of those guys who had that year off with vertigo and made the best out of it because he knows how to look at the game from a different perspective. But, man, you know, he said, you know, the thing that really struck him with you was like, I wish I would have broken a bone or torn an ACL, because vertigo, you know, sitting in this room, I doubt any of us really knows what vertigo is. And that's what he said. His teammates, his friends were like, I just don't understand what you're going through right now. It's such a weird ailment. And, it sounds pretty brutal. When you read the story, you'll be like, wow, that's something that I would not wish on my worst enemy.
Terry and Matt, thank you. You can follow these guys on Twitter. You can also follow Inside Lacrosse on Twitter. A lot of action coming up with I love the fact that you guys are getting out there, talking to players, talking to coaches, and watching practices this fall. It's really one of the fun times of the year, and I think you guys you really serve the fan. And we love to serve the fan, isn't that right, Terry?
Absolutely. Thanks, Quint.
Fall ball is about the freshmen assimilating into the team culture. It's about young players learning to follow. It's about young players dealing with failure for the first time. I remember my first fall practice. Coach Zim came out of the goal and changed the way I was holding my stick. Who was he to tell me how I was holding my stick? I remember going back to my dorm room, calling my brother and saying, I quit. I'm out of here. This is not going to work. Well, you're going to have to change some things. You're going to have to trust the coaching staff. I made those changes. It wasn't easy. You deal with failure, competing against bigger, stronger, faster guys. That's what it's like to be a college freshman. So we bring in Jeff Shannon. Inside Lacrosse Recruiting issue in October has the top 100 class of 2017. Jeff, these are guys who are on campus right now. And as a whole, after covering the Under Armour All-America game, I was impressed with their spirit, their attitude. They seem to get along tremendously, and they were all very hungry. As a group, where do you rate this 2017 class? Is it better than average? Is it average, or is it subpar?
I think this is average. The hardest part for this group is going to be the class that just played their freshman year this past year was arguably one of the best freshman classes we've seen since, I guess, go back to like Steel Stanwyck's year, which would have been, I think, in the late 2000s there. I mean, you had just so many tremendous freshman performers in that class, guys like Mike Sowers and Jeff Teed and Doc Sakin down in Virginia. Guys kind of had the radar on them and then lived up to those expectations that first year. And the depth was pretty impressive. I think this group has a lot of good talent in it. It may be in places more on the defensive side than maybe some of the star positions. But within those star positions, I think those top guys are going to be impressive, really starting with our number one recruit in Tohoka Nanako.
You know, I think it's the era that we're living in that these youngsters are more prepared to play college lacrosse coming out of high school now than they've ever been in terms of their strength, their speed, their training, the amount of time many of them have specialized to a point of being really ready to play. And then the emphasis on the fall and the teaching that's done there. And I think they're given every opportunity now to succeed as freshmen, where years ago that wasn't always the case, especially when guys were coming from the non-traditional hotbeds. You know, the game was moving pretty fast for them. But now even the players from the West Coast, from the Northwest, from the South, they're playing in so many events, the high quality events, that this is not that new to them.
No, I mean, these guys have been playing, again, even if you're from a non-hotbed, and I feel like sometimes maybe our biases go to some of those guys because it's just easy to grab them. But they've been playing in high-profile events since, you know, the 7th or 8th grade now. The game's been out in these places for 20 years. And the coaching, especially in places like California and some of the bigger states, is top-notch. So that they're seeing good talent. They know to get those guys on the in some high-profile events in the summertime. So they're seeing talent. So someone like, you know, Bubba Fairman, one of our top recruits headed to Maryland. He's out of Utah, but his game is so strong, and it's a great mix of athleticism with stick skills. He's tying up playing both out west at his high school in Brighton, but also did a PG year at Deerfield, Massachusetts, to kind of give one more year and some polish to his game. And I really think someone like that comes in and finds a place to contribute at a place like Maryland, who's especially going to be looking at kind of rebuilding their offense a little bit, and he's a piece that they're gonna get into with.
Maryland's a team that needs some help on attack, and I think Bubba Fairman will get every opportunity. You mentioned, now it's spelled Tehoga. He told me to pronounce it Tehoga.
It's Tehoga, yes.
All through a Tehoga. Nicest kid. You know, I had met him years ago at the Ride out in Portland, Oregon at the Nike facility, and he got bigger and bigger. I mean, he and it's not like he's carrying bad weight either. He is a strong guy. I was so impressed with his passing skills just in the Under Armour practice when we were doing a lot of transitional work, 3-on-2s, 4-on-3s. His ability to find the open man amazed me. I had kind of pictured him more as a powerful dodger around goal line, extended around the crease, but there's tremendous depth in his game.
Yeah, I mean, I've continuously compared him to John Grant Jr. in both his physicality and his elusiveness with his stick. Again, his ability to find the open man on the pass and or score in ways that you think he's going to come use his strength, and the ball just kind of trickles underneath your leg a little bit. I saw him play with the U19 Iroquois national team last summer against some of those top freshmen from last year against the Team USA and Team Canada, and I think that's just what stood out to me. His ability, his size mixed with his stick skills is very hard to find otherwise.
Yeah, Fairman's the number 2 ranked recruit. He'll go to Maryland. Obviously, Nandikoke will play alongside Connor Fields at Albany. It's an Albany team, as I've said, that I think can make a run for the whole cheese. Alex Trippi out of Bullis, really strong change of direction. You want to Google his some of his highlights on YouTube. He can break ankles. Connor Marin, Chris Gray, who's a little undersized, but he was really productive in the Under Armour both practice. And I thought he had a nice game. He surprised me a little. Colin Monroe, a lefty. It's a group that, quite frankly, I thought they were a little smallish as a group, the ones I saw at Under Armour.
Yeah, I would say size, you know, is maybe not the biggest strength of this group. But again, you compare that with skill and speed, and I think in lacrosse you could get away with that a little bit.
Is there someone maybe outside the top 20, Jeff, who you think an attackman, who you think has upside and may challenge for playing time immediately? Is there someone maybe on the rise, let's say from 100 to 50, who was kind of a late riser that jumps out at you?
I'll just go one just right outside of the top 25. I think someone to watch for in terms of just sheer point production this year will be Ryan Lanchberry. He gets a chance. He was a U19 player, 100 point scorer at Avon Old Farms, Canadian. We'll go into a Richmond team that will need some young guys to step up, and I think he'll have every opportunity to make a contribution there. Within some of the other guys, it's interesting. We were talking about Maryland. James Avanzado, I think, might be one of the more polished guys in terms of his background coming into Maryland, may have an opportunity to fight there. There's just a lot of talent that they're going to play with there. One guy definitely to watch, two guys actually I'll bring up, Asher Nautling, Cherry Creek going to High Point. Again, one of the best players, arguably, I know we got into this with some of the people out there, arguably the best player in Colorado in terms of individual season this past year. Should be a contributor at High Point immediately. And then someone who's kind of off our radar, again, until this past season, John Piatelli out of St. Sebastian's, Massachusetts. They have one of the better high school seasons this year. He's gone to a Cornell team where he's probably maybe a little bit more facilitator working alongside Jeff Teat, maybe setting him up a little bit, doing a lot of the dirty work, and Jeff gets the points, which is not a bad thing.
I thought Connor G. Simone was impressive. Smithtown East, he's heading at Johns Hopkins. Both his vision stood out during the Under Armour week, I thought. You know, Nikki Montgomery, I think, is going to probably start more as a transitional midi at Duke initially, and I think he'll develop more polish to his a goal-scoring game. Lucas Quinn is a guy that Terry mentioned out of Syracuse. A really wonderful knack for goal-scoring. Mm-hmm. I loved his shooting ability. He was really strong, and the way he cuts reminded me of some top-notch midfielders. You know, he's got a really strong base and nice quads. And then Michael Drake heading to Notre Dame. His split dodge, his change of direction was absolutely vicious. Let's swing to the defense because you seem high on this class. Who jumped out at you? I thought that as a group that they were pretty big and they moved well. They looked not like cookie cutter, but they're just like imposing dudes. You know, they're 6 foot to 6'2" range, all a 180 to 200. You're not the type of guys that I want to mess with. Arden Cohen, I believe, is your highest rated. He's heading to Notre Dame, the lefty, New York, and then spent some time in Connecticut as well. Notre Dame loves lefty defenders.
Yeah, they definitely do. This whole Notre Dame defensive class kind of is the core of – we had ranked them our number one defensive class in this group. Arden is up there, just really smart, straight-up defenseman. I think sometimes with the Under Armour game, what happens is we tend to lean a little bit in guys who maybe they'll play defense in the game and maybe more of a LSM-type prospect in college. But I would definitely think Arden is kind of going to be a base of their close D moving forward. Carson Cochran was also a top-ranked recruit with that group. And Schmidt, the goalie, kind of anchors that group. I liked a couple of the Brown players, which which we think, you know, when you're looking at how that team needs to operate, you need big LSMs.
Adrian Enchil, he was really, really good. He's all over the ball. He's a guy who can run really well. I was very impressed with him. And then Jackson Caputo as well. So Brown's getting two guys that I think they can plug in right away in terms of playing time, no doubt. The goalies, you know, Alex Rode of St. Paul's heading to Virginia. He'll get a chance to play immediately down in Charlottesville. They need a goalie. He's a little different in his stick, the way he holds his stick, quite honestly. And I'm interested because he makes dynamic, just explosive inside saves. He's got a knack for that. He's very light on his feet. He's very explosive. I worked with him at Nike for that week again in the ride a couple years ago, and I thought he looked very strong in practices for the Under Armour game. You think he's going to have to change that stick position, that style? I mean, it's such a low carrying. He shows so much of the top part of the cage, and at the high school level, he was able to get away with it. It'd be interesting to see if he can do that.
It's funny you tell that story to begin this podcast because that's exactly what we've been thinking about his game, and I'm intrigued to get down to Virginia this fall and see him a little bit in practice and talk with their assistant coaches about what the strategy is going to be with him. I think, again, talent-wise, explosiveness, he fits right into what they're doing at Virginia. Is that a hitch that they need to fix? I'm not quite sure whether it is. Do you ride with what he's been good at, or do you make that adjustment? It'll be interesting to see. I think he's the most important goalie recruit that we're going to see in this class. There's definitely some other guys who are talented. Some of our other kids going to Maryland, Drew Moore is going to follow up there, and then the young goalie who from Darien. Ryan Cornell was really solid. Again, he had a really great career at Darien, who ended up being one of our number one teams. Yeah, going to Vermont.
First Under Armour All-American. Correct. I think Richmond pulled in their first Under Armour All-American. Are there any PGs that people need to look out for?
Within this group, so the way that we do our rankings now, PGs get folded into this group. It's one of those things that there was some arbitrariness to it before, and like we want to introduce the kids who will be playing freshman year. One of the things that we will that we did have to make adjustments for is some of the guys in the Under Armour game, Justin Shockey, Nate Buller, some of those NAPS players. We let them they play in the game because there just won't be an opportunity for them in the future. But we won't see them until the 2019 season. They have to do a year at the Naval Prep Academy before they come back into the NCAA fold.
Those players are on campus. They're in your uniform right now. If you're a fan, their heads are probably spinning because the game's going to seem pretty fast for them. They'll get over it, and they'll assimilate into your culture, and hopefully many of them will get playing time. As you mentioned, the class of 2016 was a historic class in terms of their success. Last year's freshmen were outstanding from start to finish. Also in the October issue, in midsection, page 165, open your textbooks, folks, the 2018. So these are rising seniors nationally, and you've got ranked, what, 50 or 100 of them. And these are guys who we're going to see next year dominating. Isaiah Dawson, the number one rated rising senior in the country, a California kid headed to Harvard. What makes Dawson so special?
He has a wonderful mix of football-style athleticism, but has played the game and knows the game long enough to be a really effective player in terms of IQ. We saw his abilities playing with the Nation United club team this summer, which is an interesting story in its own. If you ever go to insidelacrosse.com and read the story there, it's a really cool story. But he really took the in a championship game against some prime New York talent. He scored the game tying and the game winning goal, really put the team on his back and used his athleticism and his stick skills to kind of stand out. I know just talking a little bit with your recruiters and whatnot, I think they would like to see him take another step in terms of making, you know, figuring out a second, third, fourth type shot. But his straight ability is really hard to match, really only by the number two recruit, Ricky Meisen, who's also a top football recruit who is committed to North Carolina and is looking to maybe balance a football and lacrosse career there. Again, just tremendous athleticism mixed with a guy who's been playing the game for a long time, so knows the game.
Yeah, he's 6'3", 220. He's gotten some legit offers to play Division I football. How do you think that's going to shake itself out?
From what I know, I think North Carolina thinks it's going to work out for them, that he'll play some football there and then lacrosse in the spring. Again, you know, interests in full rides and whatnot, you know, the football world a little bit more, but that kind of financial offset is just, you know, available in football when it's not as often in lacrosse. But I won't be surprised if Ricky is on campus playing lacrosse.
Landon had an excellent team last year. Joey Epstein was their leading point getter. He is a rising senior, plays for Madlax, and he is looking like he's going to be ended up going to Johns Hopkins. What type of game sets Joey Epstein apart?
Really good quarterback from behind, and has a good first step to cage. He is smart. I think my one question with him a year or so ago was his athleticism. I saw him a couple times in the summer. I was wondering if he'd make that step. His high school season definitely erased a lot of those questions, and I thought he really stepped up into his role as a smart offensive player for them. Kind of very similar, though, in terms of what Hopkins is getting a lot of. So I don't know in terms of when he gets to campus where he falls into that. They have so many smart lacrosse IQ guys and it's good to have someone like that coming in, but it's still a lot of them on campus.
Yeah, and that's got to be difficult for you, Jeff, because, you know, what they are at high school, I scored 80 goals and had 80 assists, mm-hmm. may not be what they are in college. Depends
Correct.
On maturity, depends on what type of team they play on, what type of club system that they, you know, they've been exposed to. This is part science and it's part art, I would think, too, when you craft this, because you got to go with the data, but then you got to massage things like, hey, this kid's 6'3", he's skinny, but he runs like a deer, and I project him to be, you know, what's he going to look like when he turns 20 is kind of my point.
Correct. I mean, that's what, and it's what coaches do on a certain level. One of the coaches, we are trying to get a full picture of everything. Coaches do have the advantage of being able to talk to these kids over and over and over again when they're building those relationships to get the mentality down, which if I had the time to do that with hundreds and hundreds of kids, I could get maybe even more focused picture on these guys. But just on talent alone and what we know and through our works, that's kind of The mix of trying to get those things together in a ranking. To me, rankings, I like doing them. They're fun. It's a little bit of arbitrariness to it. What you're looking at is pools of talent. How deep do the pools go?
New England's represented by two guys in the top 10 as well. Brian Cameron, an attackman of New Hampshire. And then you got Will Bowen, a defender, Boston College High School, played for FCA, Lexachusetts. He's heading to North Carolina. Bowen's got some terrific size.
Yeah, Bowen is one of those. We've talked with people who work with him and that crew a little bit more intimately, and he could arguably be fighting for the number one spot in this class. He's that talented in terms of who he faces. And he plays up a lot. He's played up against some of the top guys in the last year or two who are in college now, and people said he was the best defender on the field going against those guys. Really, really athletic talent who knows his position well. Cameron's more in the he's definitely thicker. I noticed that in the Under Armour games this summer. He played for the underclass New England team, one of those teams. Definitely a little bit thicker, but he mixes that with smarts and ability to score.
What's the deal with the September 1 date, and what was its impact?
It's funny. We were talking with coaches before and after that period. The impact was that, especially with guys whose relationships got cut off about 6 months ago, they were able to reach back to the class of 2019. So the one under this one, if I remember correctly, to really get those relationships started again. A lot of coaches from what we did, some of them texted at 12:01 that night, some of them made calls at 12:01 that night, some of them waited the next day. But it really was reestablishing relationships that they had built and having those kids just confirm that, and maybe set up trips for the fall, those type of things. There wasn't a lot of movement. What we think we'll see is in the class of 2020, 2021, then it'll be a little bit more of a rush to commitments. It'll be the contest and the competition will kick up for commitments in those classes, because a lot of the 2019s have been, you know, committed already verbally. Those classes that have maybe just a few, or then some of the really young ones that have none at all, that's when you'll see a lot of the competition kick in. So we're probably a couple years away from the real analysis on that date.
October issue is your recruiting issue. 17s, they're in college right now. The top 100 is the list that I'll refer to consistently throughout the spring season. You've got the 18s and then even the 19s. Jeff, what's your fall look like in terms of going forward in the late September, October, November time frame? Where are you? What events have your attention? And what's it like to be responsible to evaluate all this talent?
Well, it's nice. One of the nice things that we've been able to do is really broaden the base of analyzing these kids. So it's not just me. It's Dan Ahern. It's Terry. It's Matt. It's a collection of guys that we've hired on a freelance basis to go out there and watch kids. It's talking with coaches that work with the kids intimately, club coaches, that level. So the real base of knowledge is good. Right now, recruiting-wise, you'll have some October dates, a lot of prospect days going on right now. It's funny. I reached out to the lacrosse community on social media to see about getting people's thoughts of how those prospect days are going, especially with the new rules and the September dates going in. And then we'll have another period in November. IL runs a couple events that weekend. There's a couple other events in this region and nationally that we'll be looking at to get out and watch the new kids, especially in the 2019-2020 level, and to start building those cases. That's one thing. I don't think we'll see coaches not look at those kids anymore, because they do have to start building resumes for when that September 1st date comes in the future. Who are the 50 or 100 kids I'm reaching out to? I'm going to need to know that on that September 1st date. So I expect to see coaches out there in November along with us. So.
It's a challenging endeavor. And nowadays, as the game has grown nationally, there are more prospects. You know, players 25 through 200 or 300, you know, mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of good players. That's what I've noticed in high school that I've watched in these last few years. Everybody's really good. I mean, you know, the transcendent players are few, and just a handful of them. And last year's freshman class in college, I thought we had some superstars. But there's so many good players. So you're not on one of these lists. Don't get down. You keep grinding. You put that list up as motivation. Hit the weight room. Hit the wall. Hit the goals. Do your reps. Get your skills. And there's no reason that you can't be as successful. It has become such a bigger bigger group of talent.
Yeah, and I would say there's so many opportunities to play. I mean, we were at Rutgers this past week, and these kids, a lot of them were talking with Coach Breck. I mean, a lot of the kids were senior year commitments to him, guys. He that kind of got passed over. They become the baseline for one of the better programs. This summer at the Isle Community Academy, we saw some of the best classes were Marquette's class, were Towson's class. Some of those groups really have ample resources and opportunity to find kids at that next level and push them up and coach them up to become these premier programs that we see in the spring. And I like seeing that. I like seeing the depth have a home. You're not getting buried on a roster anymore. You're going someplace and being able to contribute immediately.
Jeff, thank you. Always interesting to when you go out to these fall events on October 7th and 8th or the 14th, 15th, or when you're following your college team, your eye needs to find those freshmen. How much playing time are they getting? How do they look? October's issue of Inside Lacrosse is your first glimpse into those classes. Thanks, Jeff.
Quint, we've talked a lot about talent today. You talked with Jeff Shannon about recruiting. Talked to John Donowski about getting the best players onto the U.S. Men's National Team. Talked to Nick Zukevich about bringing in the highest quality owners to the National Lacrosse League. You know who knows a lot about finding talent? ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, it doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by all businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right. You can do it for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lacrosse. I love saying /lacrosse because you hear these podcast reads on all these different podcasts with millions of listeners, and we know that ZipRecruiter knows that we're the lacrosse podcast. We really appreciate that.
We're also the source for recruiting in the October issue, 17s, 18s, and 19s. November is the adversity issue, and pretty soon we'll be talking about the preseason rankings, and you know, a lot of that goes on as we take a glimpse at fall ball. Never overreacting, never, you know, making final decisions, but putting that in the mix. It's a giant soup or salad. You know, what's a team like Penn or Bryan or Marquette bring back to the table? You know, our Army had a big record last year, but they fizzled late. What does Casey Reese mean to Navy? Who's going to help out Spencer at Loyola? You know, Virginia's got Doc Aiken and Michael Krause and Conrad. You know, not sold on their defense, and they'll probably be playing a freshman goalie. Let's see. Hopkins, you got face-offs, goaltending, and close defense. Short sticks. Who's going to play shorty for Johns Hopkins? So when you're watching these games this fall, I hope you're looking for some of those key areas. So we enjoyed bringing you this podcast today, and we'll hopefully have one to wrap up the fall as we head towards Thanksgiving. It's InsideLacrosse.com. It's Inside Lacrosse on Twitter. I'm Quint Kesnick. It's at Q Kesnick on Twitter. And have a great fall, everybody. And let's get things rolling.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.